I'm Hannah Young, and you're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world. Welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, your host, Toby Usnick. Today we have as our guest, Anne Vello-Wagner. She is the executive director of the Mars Wrigley Foundation. She has a wealth of experience in global strategy, program and partnership development, employee engagement, international grant making, and process improvement. She leads the foundation's global partnership and programs in 20 plus countries around the world, working closely with executive members of the foundation board of directors to drive meaningful impact in under-resourced communities. The foundation's initiatives, which we will talk about today, focus on nurturing well-being by cultivating physical, emotional, and social resilience through collaborative partnerships. And these efforts involve a holistic approach to oral health, enhancement of community spaces to elevate quality of life, strengthening social connections within communities, and providing vital support to the most vulnerable populations. Anne Vello-Wagner, welcome to the Caring Economy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So, Anne, I always ask my guests to open up by giving us maybe 3 or 4 minutes sort of spiel on their life story, how they got where they got, where you were raised, maybe how you got your values, and how you found your career path. So take it away.
Well, I am proud Chicagoan, born and raised. I grew up on the far southeast side of the city, which was primarily very industrial. And when the steel mills and some of that industry started to close, a lot of the investment in that community started to also dwindle. So really lived through that in my childhood. I'm from a very close-knit Mexican family. And really, my mom was a great role model for me as I was growing up. She was very active in the community, mm-hmm. and in the latter part of her career worked for a local nonprofit. So she was, you know, active in the local sense, but also very well aware of what was happening and broader issues. And so she was supportive of the farm workers movement and the movement that Cesar Chavez was leading, even though it was all the way on the West Coast, but the implications across the country. And I remember going with her when I was little, you know, to pass out flyers at the local grocery store to just bring awareness to this important issue. We're a very humble means, but again, you know, it was like doing what you can with the resources that you have to make your community a better place, to raise awareness about other human rights issues that may be happening in the broader community. And I think she got that from her family. She was one of 17 children.
Whoa.
raised in a small 3-bedroom home. You know, my grandfather had 2 full-time jobs, you know, again, just a fixture in the community. They were very active in their local church. But there were always stories growing up that I heard consistently about how family members helped other families in the community. And even my grandfather bringing in a family that lost their home. And again, thinking about the number of people that he had living in, they had in their small house, he fixed up an area of their basement to bring this family in the winter to come live there. And that always stuck with me, because it just makes you realize that no matter what you have, there's always a way that you can help others. There's often this idea that you have to have immense wealth, or you have to, you know, we do see a lot of very famous people and big names and big dollar amounts in the media about gifts that are given, and those are wonderful things, mm-hmm. but it helps to stay grounded in that whatever you have, there's always a way that you can share, you can help others. And so I always felt like there was this path of service that just naturally was part mm-hmm. of my life. And when I was just starting out, just out of college, it was just looking for opportunities to volunteer scraping by until I found my career and all of those things. But again, there's always those opportunities, whether it's within your own family, outside of your family. And do feel fortunate that it has led me into this career. But I think it's also taking all of those learnings with me of being on the community level, coming from a community that often was disinvested and that has had opportunities to look at how do you work to collaborate with others, to bring in other supports, and how do you in turn provide that support where it's needed.
I like that metaphor of a path of service. I do think that, I mean, many of my guests I've shared this conversation with, I think we're all meant to serve, and that's the way to a purpose-driven life, purpose-driven career. It sounds like you've gotten that through multiple generations in your family. You grew up in the south of Chicago and then went off to college. You started working. How did you get where you got today?
Sure. Yeah, I did go to college. I was the first in my family to go to college. I was fortunate that I was a very good student, was able to secure a scholarship. After that, I had a few jobs, which led me to the Wrigley Company. I had started there at an entry-level position, was able to work my way up, always looking for new opportunities. And one of those opportunities was within what was the Wrigley Company Foundation at the time. And the person who was leading some of what I would call a grants management position, which it wasn't called that back then, was going to retire. And I really just saw that as a great opportunity to do so much more.
Yeah.
And lucky for me, there was leadership at the time that also saw that and really went in and fundamentally started to build the basics around having the foundation become much more of a process-driven type of operation, to start to engage more with the board, take on a bigger role over time. Wrigley then was acquired by Mars, and at that point was able to go into a different area of the business, came back around in 2016 to join as the executive director of what is now the Mars Wrigley Foundation. Over those years, I did go back to school, I went to grad school, and so I've always enjoyed learning. I consider myself, I think most people, I hope, consider themselves lifelong learners.
Mm-hmm.
So this role also suits me in that respect. I think there's always an opportunity to learn. This is such a dynamic area. There's never a time where you have it all figured out.
Yeah.
I feel very, very fortunate in that sense.
Yeah. Well, I suspect you're also, like me, a lifelong learner, but also probably an instructor by nature as well. I'm sure you actually help people learn and glean lessons along the way. So before we talk about the foundation specifically, can you set up for our audience the whole Mars Wrigley conglomerate, so we kind of know not only what it is or how it came to be, but then what are some of the more noted brands that our audience would recognize?
Sure. And on the Mars Wrigley side of the house, so we are part of Mars Incorporated, and there are several businesses. The largest, interestingly enough, is our pet business, which has many brands that folks would be familiar with on the pet food side. So if you think about Pedigree and Iams and Whiskas, and those are some of the pet brands. And then there's a whole veterinary health side of that business. But then the other significant side, and almost as large, is our Mars snacking business. And so on the Mars Wrigley side, we have many treats and snacks that we all grew up with very fondly when you think of Twix and M&M's, Snickers. We have our gum, and just a lot of the brands, again, that are so familiar. And that's what's always great, to hear the stories that people connect to our brands.
Yep.
And within that, we also have Mars Food, which is another part of the business. So we have Ben's Original and Seeds of Change that are part of our food business.
And I know, because I mentioned to you before the interview, I went to high school in Hackettstown, New Jersey, which was with the headquarters for M&M Mars. So I definitely remember M&M's fondly. But if I remember correctly, it's you're privately held and it's an Australian family, the Mars family. Is that correct?
It is privately held. The Mars family, they're here in the U.S.
Okay.
But you are, yes, it is privately held.
Privately held. And I've known from the outside looking in through the years, just the values, the family-driven values that drive the brand and the business. I think it generates a lot of goodwill internally and externally. Is that your observation? And can you tell us a little bit about that and how it feels to be there?
Yes, it is very values-driven. We have what we call our Mars 5 principles. And coming from the Wrigley side of the business, as we were acquired and became part of the Mars business, you heard about these five principles everywhere. And a lot of businesses have their value statements, and they are sometimes just words on a wall. So I really wasn't sure how to interpret that, but over the years understood that they are truly lived, they are referenced. And that's when you understand, how special a business is, when you see those values really brought into decision making on a regular basis. And so it was, again, a nice way to come into a privately held business in terms of feeling those values align with your own personal values as well.
You know, I've worked on many M&A deals throughout my career, and the culture piece is always the toughest one, right? Who acquires whom and what are the values? And it can be a disaster or it can be successful. It takes time, but it sounds like you've been successfully merged there.
Yes, you're right. It's so critical. And again, it comes back to, how you make decisions, how you, work together. And so when you see that and you live that, you can really easily, fit into the culture, if you will, because again, it essentially is what it espouses to be.
Yeah. So now you're executive director of the Mars Wrigley Foundation. Give us a little sort of overview of what that is all about, and maybe sort of the, your day-to-day, what you're up to.
What I'm up to day-to-day. So that's always interesting, right? There's no 2 days are alike. So that's the good thing. And one of the things that I think gives me energy. But as you had mentioned in the introduction, the mission of the foundation really centers around, nurturing well-being. And we think of that in terms of, physical, emotional, social resilience. And we've all heard a lot, I think, about recent studies that have talked about, disconnection. There have been studies done that speak to, there was a Harvard study, I think, that was done, and there was quite a bit of media earlier in the year around this. It was one of the longest studies done on adult development, and talked about the benefits of close relationships. And close relationships really, more than money, fame, those are the elements that really keep people happy throughout their lives, and just the importance of those connections. They also saw ties that brought, that correlated with delay in mental and physical decline, and that those close connections were actually a better predictor of like long and happy lives than social class, IQ, even gene. And just really compelling. And there have been other studies as well in this space that again really looks at just how beneficial and how important those connections, those opportunities to really form close social bonds are. And so this is an area that the foundation has been moving in, looking at where are those opportunities, where are those spaces for the community to come together and to connect. And they're not in every community. And I spoke about growing up in a disinvested community, and there are communities that do not have those types of resources. And those resources are so important in terms of, you know, quality of life and being able to have those spaces. And so we started a pilot project in late 2019 to really look at expanding into this work. And going into 2020, the pandemic hit, and so we had to pause that work. But then as we moved out of the crisis mode of COVID, started to then go back. We did an assessment, wanted to look and really evaluate the pilot and glean some of the insights coming out of that to look at expanding that work. And so now that's what I'm just starting to do, to roll this out into other site communities where Mars Wrigley has a presence around the world, and then really look at hyper-local community level. What are the resources that are available? There are assets in every community, and we want to understand what those assets are. Even in the most disinvested communities, the people themselves are the assets. They understand what's needed. They understand what would be most beneficial. And so listening to those voices, looking for those partners at the community level to help inform that work, and for those opportunities where we could make a meaningful investment, where we perhaps can build other collaborations to come on board with that work as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, again today on the Caring Economy, we have as our guest Ann Bella Wagner. She's the executive director of the Mars Wrigley Foundation, based in Chicago, but with a global remit. And to that point, could you give us an example of how the rubber meets the road, where one of these initiatives might be happening and what it looks like? And then two, how it might look on the other side of the world?
It's a great question, because there's quite a variant. One of the projects that we had implemented in Nairobi, Kenya, that was part of the pilot, was in a very, very disinvested area of Nairobi. We worked with a local community-based organization that focused on young women and girls, and they had a unique way of supporting their education. One element was to build up their basketball skills to help them get scholarships, sports scholarships, to further their education. And in working with them, where they needed an investment was one in the basketball court itself. So not just to improve the court, open air roof, and so to protect them from the suns, and then to also build out a true computer center, a learning center for the students that they served. And so we provided support for those areas, and shortly thereafter is when COVID hit. And this is where it gets really interesting, because yes, they understood the needs of the students that they served. They understood the needs of the community. They had this unique model. They were really leveraging all of their assets, if you will. And we were able to make these investments, help them really expand their work. When the pandemic hit, that was where community went to meet, to understand, the basics in terms of what was happening, so that basketball court became this convening space because it was safe, it was outdoors. The computer center, when schools closed, was literally the only place they could go to be connected to educational resources. We think about our kids were learning at home, or you hear these stories, but that wasn't even an option. And so took that investment in areas where we couldn't have predicted, and it will continue to serve the community and be a sustained asset. Now, an example in the U.S. is an organization. I'll take an organization here in Chicago that is based on the west side of the city, and it is an area that has been historically disinvested. One of the community needs is just grocery stores and fresh produce. There's lack of local access to that, and this organization has transformed empty lots into community garden spaces. They then take that produce and they have a local market area where they're able to sell it at very low cost to the local community. But they also wanted to build awareness for the market and bring in even more community members to that space. So we helped them on not just to invest more in terms of their garden network, but also in an art installation that really celebrated what they called the food heroes in their community. Mm-hmm. So the people leading this work, but also local restaurant owners and other community members that were just doing great work in this space. They saw themselves, and they truly are heroes in their own community. But as you see the familiar faces, that welcomes you, that makes you, recognize those people in your community.
Absolutely.
You feel fellowship with. And again, it builds that community in terms of that market space. So it really is letting the community-based organizations identify, they know what works, they know what is needed, and being their partner to truly listen and to work with them to provide, the investment to really just, again, do what they're doing, but make it even better.
Yeah. I think particularly with the community garden, it's so interesting in this day and age for young people to see how produce is grown, because we're so removed from it. And those become teachable moments in my experience, where actually you have pride and watch and the patience to see things grow or not. And that's where I think you can really spark that sort of imagination and more than just feeding someone, right? You can actually give them inspiration toward maybe even a career goal. I wonder if you could give us a sense of the size of your budget or the amount of grants you give out each year, something that gives us a sense of scale of Mars Wrigley Foundation.
Sure. My budget is just over $6 million annually. And again, it is global in terms of scale. We do look for opportunities, both in terms of community-based organizations, where we have a presence. And then we also have some global partnerships that we are able to work with at a broader scale.
And how does your
really foster that work?
I suspect that you're also interfacing very closely with the employee population there. So in terms of volunteerism, service, does that dovetail with your work? Do you oversee that work? How does that happen?
Yes, it does. In any time we can bring our assets together with our partners, it is definitely what we want to do. So it's at the local level with, hands-on type of volunteer work. We also have a skills-based volunteer program, which is global. And again, we partner with many of our existing grantee partners, but that is actually a program that is on an annual basis. We're able to bring in a competitive process where we scope projects with our nonprofit partners to meet an existing need and allow our associates to bring their skills to bear. So if they're a marketing professional, accounting, HR, logistics, we have an abundance of talent on our team, and they will go on these scoped assignments, leave their day-to-day job in the business. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they may travel to an entirely different country because it is a global program, mm-hmm. to go work on site and 100% dedicate their time to that project. Mm-hmm. They are paid their salary during this time. This is not vacation time. They are there in service alongside, but fulfilling an existing need for that partner. And these are incredible projects. They bring so much value. And again, for me personally, it's all about bringing all of our assets to bear. Mm-hmm. And our people are so passionate about this work as well. So I feel very fortunate to be able to be that bridge and make those connections and help them find those opportunities through this program.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like best in class to me from what I've seen in the space, that sort of holistic approach to impact. I wonder if, not speaking about Mars Ridley Foundation, but about philanthropy, corporate philanthropy in general, what have you seen perhaps evolve over the years in your career, or what's perhaps moving in the right direction, or is an improvement, or conversely, what's still kind of broken? I think we're long past the days of just writing a check for, say, breast cancer awareness or something. It's got to be really integrated into the brand to succeed. But I wonder, I mean, that's my take, but I wonder what you might say about the ecosystem.
I do agree with you. I think it has become much more strategic. Mm-hmm. It is those projects and those organizations that truly understand that it has to be aligned with your overall strategy, or it's not going to be sustainable. You can't, to your point, just write the check over here and it's totally disassociated with the industry that you're in. It really, the expectation, frankly, is that you are going to be much more engaged. I would say the younger generation that's coming into the workforce, that's in the workforce now and just starting out their careers, have that expectation as well.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a great thing to see, that we are all much more civic minded, and there is that expectation that yes, you're going to take your talents and bring them to work with you every day, but where are there opportunities that you can also share what you know and what you do for the greater good?
I mean, I so agree with your take and the approach. I wonder though, there are countervailing forces that, charges of wokeism, or that corporations should stay focused on shareholder profit. And I wonder how if you get those kinds of accusations or charges, or how you address them, because I'd like to think they're the minority voice and that will stay the course because it's the right thing to do for both profit and purpose. But I'm not working at Mars Wrigley, and I wonder what are challenges that you have there, if any, or is everyone on board?
those types of comments are everywhere nowadays, and
absolutely.
We've all heard them, seen them. But yes, again, it comes back to just staying true to your values. Okay. This is, an example of that. And when we think about, the mission of the foundation, we talk about building those connections. That is one example of why it's even more important nowadays to build those connections, to have those opportunities to come together, to look for those opportunities to build community. Yeah. And it is so needed now.
Yeah, I actually think that you are particularly well placed in your industry because you have this stable, amazing, beloved brands. And those brands are built on the kind of relationship building that you're describing. And I think that trains us well for making it through these kinds of issues. Would you agree?
Definitely. And our brands build happiness. They're you know, we talk about these, you know, small moments of everyday happiness, and that's what it's about. And we shouldn't forget that. Those are important things. You know, someone gives you a smile, holds the door open for you. These are simple acts, you know, shares a piece of gum, simple things, but they do mean a lot. They do brighten your day. You know, it does change your outlook, and you never know what someone is going through that day. And sometimes that is all it takes. It's just that one little moment.
Absolutely. I'm smiling because I love peanut M&M's. It's my favorite. And I love the whole Maya Rudolph campaign with him. Like, you know, obviously you want to listen and hear all people's points of view, but at the end of the day, you also have to stay true to your North Star, your brand, your values. And I think there's also something to be said for being able to actually poke a little fun or have a little fun sometimes in these more serious issues. So I thank you for that. So my last question for you, Anne, is pearls of wisdom, any sort of advice you've gleaned in your career about living a purpose-driven life, a purpose-driven career, or helping people find their way when they're trying to do a similar thing that you've done?
Wow, I'd say be a good listener, number one. And part of that is always be open to learning. You're never going to have all of the answers. Ask for help when you need it, and that's an important thing. And be able to give help as well. So any opportunity in terms of peers that reach out, in terms of you know, just people within the business on a day-to-day basis, where there is an opportunity to help. And again, it doesn't have to be at this grand scale. It is usually built within those small moments that can often be the most meaningful. So take the time and look for those opportunities.
Great messages. I love that path of service again. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been my delight today to have Anne Bella Wagner with us. She's the executive director of the Mars Wrigley Foundation. As a lifelong lover of so many of the products in their stable, I can't thank you enough, Anne, for joining us. And I hope you'll come back and share more about the impact you're having globally.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Toby.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at @TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing The Caring Economy with your friends and colleagues.